Hello, and welcome to this, the final Critical Voter podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber, and apparently we settle an argument this week, or perhaps a set of arguments, by making a choice regarding who will be president of the United States. Often this is the time journalists stand back and marvel at the achievement of power being passed peaceably via democratic vote, a storyline that takes on particular resonance when the leader of one party, especially one that's held the presidency for many terms, willingly hands the White House keys over to a rival party. This time we voted for continuity, with not just the president, but the makeup of both houses of Congress remaining largely unchanged. But this should in no way diminish the achievement of a nation of so many citizens with so many opinions ready to settle political disputes through the ballot box. But elections are also one of those rare times in life when we get to see arguments settled, or at least decisions made decisively. In contrast, when someone makes a major decision at work or we make a choice at home, it's often just a matter of time before these decisions get modified, reversed, watered down, or abandoned, often so gradually that no one notices. But a vote is a decisive, legally binding act, and even if we don't like the choice or choices the electorate has made, there's no denying that a decision was reached. People with far more political insight than I will be writing about the outcome of the election for the next few weeks. And the only political point I can add has to do with a word I just mentioned, continuity. This point is built on what we talked about back in podcast number 11 regarding the human mind's craving for consistency, which tends to limit just how much a democratic electorate is willing to tolerate in terms of rapid change. But it's also built on perspective gained from having lived through 10 presidencies over 13 elections, six of which involve switches regarding which party owns the White House. And it's colored by the fact that each of those 13 elections, and I suspect ones that took place before, were all cast, and no doubt considered by many, to be the most significant vote in our lifetimes, if not the history of the Republic. So while we should in no way minimize the historic significance of this or any other election, we should also keep in mind the level of continuity that our political system tends to enforce. For instance, and as I just mentioned, the power relationship between the White House and Congress and most of the elected officials and advisors sitting in various seats on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue remain unchanged. And even had the election gone a different way, whoever was elected would have been forced to focus on the same issues during their term, including brewing fiscal crises at home and abroad and the emergence of a new generation of overseas enemies and global threats. Some of these crises and threats, as well as opportunities, involve historic trends and situations that are going to play out regardless of who occupies the Oval Office. At home, for instance, the alleged most powerful man on earth will have to navigate a divided electorate made up of organizations and powerful constituencies. And overseas, he needs to work with existing systems of alliances that have been built up over decades, which again limit just how much any president can achieve or even control. Having just mentioned the electorate, I'd like to focus on them, meaning us for a little while. We have just been treated to another presidential campaign that, as I predicted during the first podcast, seems strikingly similar to those I've seen over the last couple of decades. First, you had all those negative ads, which, if you're lucky or unlucky enough to live in a swing state, were different from the past only in terms of the people being pilloried and the frequency they appeared in your TV screen, or this time around, your computer screen, tablet, or smartphone. Then there were the debates, which, with the exception of the first one, fit the template we're all familiar with, that of the joint press conference with candidates doing all they could to deliver their prepared talking points without ever actually engaging with one another. Election night featured the latest versions of interactive maps with three-dimensional animation effects. These were delivering the same messages we saw in 2D 4, 8, 12, and 16 years ago, a state-by-state, voting-district-by-voting-district breakdown that continually highlighted how much your vote was taken for granted if you lived outside one of the small geographies that were truly up for grabs. I mentioned on the blog how mapping technology, driven by databases containing population and voting statistics, made it simple to parse the numbers in order to determine exactly where candidates should spend their time and money. Similarly, the technology used to test a new TV sitcom or advertising campaign can also be used to monitor the public's reaction to candidate messaging on a second-by-second basis. Within our own lives, the internet lets us create or subscribe to our own fact-checking services and make them part of a custom news feed designed to fit comfortably with our existing beliefs. And the technology also decreases the cost and thus increases the frequency of those polls we all salivate over while decrying their turning what should be a political debate into a numbers-driven horse race. But this technology has only accelerated the professionalization of campaigns that began before computers enter our homes, with armies of consultants, media experts, statisticians, and psychologists working tirelessly to predict and control every second between when a candidate first throws his hat into the ring through inauguration. This is why campaign rhetoric seems so much like marketing rhetoric these days, since each candidate has writers, producers, and directors coaching them regarding how to talk, dress, and gesture, rewarding skills such as the ability to maintain a look of sincerity while reading from a teleprompter. This may also explain why so many people you know, and possibly you as well, got through this election without learning much you didn't believe already, without having a single meaningful argument over any substantial issue. Theoretically, all these resources dedicated to making the political campaign seem stable and predictable should put we voters at ease. After all, consistency is what our brains crave, which is why inconsistency makes our skin crawl. But strangely enough, this particular type of predictability seems to unnerve us, possibly because it is an artificial consistency that, among other things, serves our presidential candidates who seem less and less like human beings and more like TV characters working off a script. This dynamic also makes us distrustful of anyone presenting information or points of view we don't agree with, even if we can't explain why, which is why we surround ourselves not just with news sources, but neighbors and friends who will not tell us anything we don't want to hear, even if this leaves us in a state of self-imposed ignorance, which also makes us uncomfortable, at least at the subconscious level. Now, all this uneasiness might be worth it if the money and energy spent trying to make the election as predictable as possible actually worked. But if you look at the two events that had the most dramatic impact on the election, Mitt Romney's 47% video and the first debate, they both arose out of reality blowing a big hole in the candidates' carefully prepared scripts. The first debate was particularly telling since, before it took place, President Obama was counting on the science of campaigning to do its job by defining his opponent as a heartless plutocrat, an image only reinforced by that 47% video, who was no match for the president's stunning oratory. But once his science, which is really nothing more than superstition, failed, and Mitt Romney revealed himself to be something other than what he was portrayed at, this not only increased the Republicans' ethos quotient, but damaged the credibility of those who had put so much time and spent so many dollars creating this portrait, a mistake which almost cost Obama his re-election. You saw similar clinging to superstitious belief masquerading as science during the weeks after that debate, when every poll was scrutinized, challenged if it didn't say what you wanted, embraced if it made you happy, consolidated with other polls, and synthesized into polls of polls for which even more scientific rigor was claimed. Republican attitudes towards polling data took a particularly bizarre turn towards the end of the campaign, where every poll saying the president was likely to win was interpreted to mean the opposite, based on suspicion that biased media sources behind these polls were cooking the books to make their preferred candidate's victory seem inevitable. During this period, proofiness, the willingness to lend particular credence to mathematical data that confirms your opinions, reigned supreme, with no one willing to admit that in a fast-changing race that would eventually come down to decisions made by millions of individuals, no single poll or poll of polls or poll of poll of polls was going to be able to tell us the future. Of course, after an election, everything the winner did will seem strategic and brilliant, and those lucky enough to have been behind polls that turned out to be right will be hailed for their genius, at least until they lead their next client candidate over a cliff. And speaking of cliffs, one of the most cogent analyses of all this professionalization and psychology and science applied to politics, which I read in a blog years ago that unfortunately I can no longer locate, likened attempts to keep our political process stable and predictable to the various financial instruments designed before the prime mortgage fiasco that were supposed to not just minimize but eliminate risk by collateralizing it, spreading it out, and I suppose sucking it into another dimension. Except it didn't. Simply created the illusion of risk-free predictability that was nothing more than a narrow bridge with sheer cliff on either side, and as it turned out, on the far end as well. And if we let the political process continue down the same path, we should anticipate a wake-up call as big or bigger than the economic meltdown we saw 5 years ago in our political lives, with surprises like the 47% video or the first debate just small tastes of the kind of shocks the world stands ready to offer us, especially if we delude ourselves into thinking we've banished surprise from our politics, just as some of us believe we've banished discomfort from our lives and the law of the jungle from the world. Now, we could try to solve problems in our political system by changing that system through a process commonly referred to as reform. For example, we could take yet another stab at trying to get money out of politics through campaign finance reform, public financing, or demands that candidates pledge to reject money people are perpetually offering them. The trouble with this approach is that it's been tried again and again and has always failed since money, like water, will always find a way around the obstacles put in its path. I suppose there are new approaches we have not yet tried, laws or court rulings declaring who can donate how much to who, or new internet-driven shaming rituals that expose those who take too much. But given that after decades of such reforms, a candidate still managed to spend $2.6 billion on this year's presidential race, perhaps we need to take a look somewhere else for a solution. And one thing we can look at is what that $2.6 billion was used to buy, starting with a big hunk of it dedicated to researching, creating, producing, and deploying advertising on television, YouTube, and elsewhere designed to persuade and often manipulate the public. But what if the public can no longer be manipulated through the devices and techniques used in these expensive ads? More specifically, what if we, the people, understood how the tools of persuasion work just as well as those who create those TV spots and other persuasive devices? If such a transformation took place, there would be no need to demand the candidates raise and spend less money, since it wouldn't matter if they spent $1 million, $1 billion, $2.6 billion, or $11 trillion on ads that no longer worked on a public that was every bit as wise to the persuaders as they think they are to us. Keep that $2.6 billion in mind for a moment, since we can begin to use it to place a dollar figure on the value of not just you and I, but of all of us becoming critical thinkers. Actually, let's just use that $2.6 billion as a starting point for the cost of not changing a way of thinking. Since no candidate would be willing to spend more than $1 billion to become president, the value of success was not much higher. In this case, the trillions in spending the president gets to influence, not to mention the other extraordinary powers he exercises. But in contrast to these billions or even trillions of dollars, the cost of becoming a critical thinker, able to see through that expensive campaign rhetoric and understand an even more expensive government activity that the winning candidate gets to oversee, is nothing. We know it's nothing because that's exactly what you spent learning the critical thinking tools we've covered here on Critical Voter over the last few months. And while there's certainly other classes or courses you can go through to learn similar skills, the cost of even the most expensive of these would barely represent a rounding error compared to the dollar value associated with mastering these skills. Now, time is money, I suppose. At the very least, we shouldn't minimize the fact that learning something new will take time away from our already over-busy lives. But if you add up all the time you spent listening to the podcast lessons over the last couple of months, that totals less than 8 hours. In fact, only slightly more than half that time was spent teaching you specific things like biases, argumentation, modes of persuasion, rhetoric, and the like, with the rest of the time looking at examples of these techniques provided either by me or by one of the guests we've had on the show. In other words, if the dollar price of becoming a critical thinker is nothing, or next to nothing, the time commitment is less than what you spend in a single day at work. In fact, it's probably less than the commuting time many of you do in a single week. And even putting aside the billion or trillion dollar sums I mentioned that relate to political decision making, if you can use these tools to inform just your next purchasing decision, any money you save, even if it's just a few dollars divided by the cost of becoming a critical thinker, which as I said is zero, comes out to a value ratio of infinity. But here's the catch. For you cannot simply spend the 7-8 hours needed to learn about bias, the modes of persuasion, argumentation, rhetorical devices, fallacies, consistencies, media and information literacy, and or other topics you might learn in similar courses, and be done with it. Rather, you must put this new knowledge to work immediately in order to transform an understanding of these techniques into an ingrained, practical, and permanent skill. If you don't, this information will simply fade, just like the knowledge of how to use a software program I learned 6 months ago evaporated because I didn't use it right away. And if you allow them to disappear, then you'll unfortunately have to start the process of learning them all over again. But if knowledge of one or more of these subjects transforms into a skill, part of your mental muscle memory, there's a strong chance it'll provide an immediate benefit to your life, which then creates a positive reinforcement mechanism, which internalizes a skill and makes you hungry to master the next one. We saw an example of this last week when my son, an 8th grader, demonstrated what he had learned by following the podcast and reading the Critical Voter blog. In several instances, this exposure allowed him to identify certain language tools or persuasive techniques, such as this use of the rhetorical device chiasmus or that use or overuse of pathos in an argument. But his most significant growth came from the skill he applied and internalized, the use of deliberative, future-oriented argumentation. By looking to the future versus dwelling on the past, he was able to create a persuasive history essay, thus getting a good grade. He was able to minimize fruitless finger-pointing and spats he had with his parents and friends. Once he realized how well this technique worked, he began to use it again and again and again until, one hopes, it becomes second nature. Keeping that example in mind, you should start to see why the presidential election was such a useful example for us to use as we began to learn more and more critical thinking tools. For arguments, be they deliberative or otherwise, are close to the surface in our everyday lives. But other important concepts, such as rhetorical devices or the modes of persuasion, are never laid out more explicitly than they are in situations involving formal oratory, like an election campaign. Rhetorical devices are a perfect case in point. Yes, some people might make use of them in their everyday speaking and writing, but more often than not, you encounter them when someone is making a formal speech or writing an editorial. And once you've been exposed to them, you could begin to make a hobby of spotting them, which might lead you to start using them, or at least understanding when they are being used by others to try to influence you. In addition to spotting the rhetorical device, people also like to spot fallacies, particularly in places like online debate forums. And while this is often done in a one-sided way, condemning fallacies of your opponents while ignoring them from your allies, Being able to identify fallacies, even in such a biased manner, represents a substantial improvement over not having any idea what they are and how they are used. But from rhetoric and fallacy spotting, one needs to make the leap to understanding. In the case of fallacies, this requires a basic understanding of logic. While the techniques you've learned in this course, notably the use of syllogisms and Toulmin diagrams, give you the tools you need to turn arguments presented in plain language into a format that can be analyzed for the important qualities of validity and soundness, logic is one of those areas that I strongly recommend you put more time into studying, since it is so rich that, as I mentioned back in podcast number 3, it might end up becoming the basis of a career. Just ask any computer programmer. As your understanding of fallacies, rhetorical devices, modes of persuasion, and many other techniques we've covered grows, it will become impossible for you to avoid seeing them being used all around you. By that sales rep trying to sell your company new security software through an appeal to fear. By a town meeting member using the rhetorical device anaphora to liven up her speech regarding a traffic proposal. By a TV ad that tries to convince you of massive savings based on a fallacious use of numbers, such as an average savings with no context as to how the average has been calculated. Or by your child using a deliberative argument to convince you that he or she should be allowed to stay up past his bedtime. Now, I wish I was selling something that was all gain and no pain, but there's one hurdle you need to get over to become a critical thinker that is not just about mastering and internalizing a skill. I'm talking, of course, about overcoming bias. For bias is the great black hole that can nullify everything else you want to do as a critical thinker. As I just mentioned, if you're going to use your knowledge of fallacies to poke holes in your opponent's arguments while ignoring equally fallacious statements your friends and even you use all the time, it doesn't matter if you've memorized each and every one of the hundreds of fallacies, including both our English and Latin names, for in such cases, this knowledge simply becomes a tool to allow you to shore up your confirmation biases by subjecting those who challenge them and no one else to exposure and ridicule. Similarly, logic only applied offensively is less than useless, since, first and foremost, logic should be used to ensure that your arguments are as sound and valid as they could possibly be. If you're only going to use logic to dismantle your opponent's position and never expose your own to rigorous scrutiny, you might as well skip the whole thing and just shout your opponent down or ignore him or her completely. Now, don't think for a moment that I'm insisting that critical thinkers not take strong stands or hold strong positions on politics or anything else. But you are required to challenge your own opinions as rigorously as you challenge those of others. And you need to understand when and where these strong opinions may or may not be relevant. To understand what I'm talking about with regard to relevance, can any of you guess how I voted in last week's presidential election? As it happens, I actually have strong political opinions that heavily influence my choice. But if you can't guess what those are from listening to this podcast over the last 15 weeks, then I've done my job, since those biases, which certainly exist, were not relevant for this exercise and were thus successfully put aside. And with regard to challenging your own bias, this can actually be the most constructive thing you do with regard to becoming a critical thinker, an exercise that will allow you to utilize every one of the tools you've learned to positive effect. For if you believe your opinion so strongly, you should welcome the chance to map your arguments into syllogisms or other types of structured formats so you could spot their strengths and weaknesses. Because if you could find a flaw, so can a potential opponent. So rather than live with your own biases and ignore anyone who does try to challenge them, why not shore up your arguments, make them stronger, more logical, more persuasive, more powerful, and seek out equally skilled interlocutors with different opinions so you can actively test out those beliefs you hold dear? Ah, but what if there's no one out there opposing your views who is doing so honestly, since anyone who disagrees with you must be doing it out of ignorance or malice? I suppose this could be the case, but it's a pretty big world out there. Which means that if you truly believe that anyone who disagrees with you must be ignorant or dishonest, I suspect that you have failed to apply the principle of charity, which asks you to assume the best of your opponents and take on their strongest arguments rather than dismissing them or pouncing on a weak point or grammatical error, all to avoid their strongest case. If this sounds lame or wishy-washy, then you've missed the entire point of the principle of charity, since this principle does not require you to accept weak and lame arguments from an opponent who is clearly not living by this principle. In fact, if you find yourself debating someone who's strategically ignoring all the important points you're making, you are free to ignore them entirely since they are not a genuine debating partner. Or better yet, you should use all the skills you've learned to expose their weakness by dismantling their strongest arguments while they flail away at straw men or attack points you never made and demolish their own ethos in the process. I don't know how many times during this year's election I heard people I like and respect spout off about allegations of Mitt Romney's high school bullying or Barack Obama's hidden past as a campus radical. Never mind allegation of cocaine dealing or pet abuse, which left me wanting to grab them by their lapels, even though most people don't wear lapels any longer, and shout, "Are you so unable to explain, much less defend, the political positions you supposedly believe deeply that you've got to spend the entire election cycle obsessed with irrelevant trivia?" I suppose how someone behaved during high school or college does provide some kind of window into the man they've become, But how many of us would like to be judged by such a metric? And more importantly, did those who spent this election working themselves up into a lather about the latest trivia do so because they believe in their cause with great passion? Or they do so because they're afraid they can no longer articulate their beliefs, much less argue them? This is the price of bias. And if you're afraid of subjecting your own opinions to the tools and techniques that can expose their weaknesses as well as their strengths, then you are not and probably cannot be a critical thinker. But if you do decide to take such a journey, be prepared to surprise yourself. For instance, you might discover that your opinions are sound, rational, and compelling, and with a little work can be made even sounder, more compelling, and virtually unstoppable. Or you might find that something you believed all your life deserves to be questioned. In which case, changing your mind is not an example of weakness, but of great strength. And if we, the people, can embrace our strongly held, well-analyzed belief and show the courage to change our minds when a view turns out to be unsupportable or, gasp, situations change, think how liberating this will be to the next round of presidential candidates who will be able to say things like, "Let me think about that a little more," or "I changed my mind on that subject and here's why," without being treated to 30 lashes for being uninformed, vacillating, or worst of all, a flip-flopper. Imagine a political campaign where candidates don't do everything in their power to evade discussions of vital issues of the day, but welcome the challenge of engaging opponents in serious argumentation. Imagine a situation where defining your opponents through negative TV ads is doomed to failure, regardless of how much money is thrown at the effort, requiring the candidates to apply the principle of charity by taking each other seriously in discussions of vital issues like war and peace or the economy. Imagine a contest where leaders don't vie to hire the best marketing consultants and make their positions sound so vague that no one will object to them, but rather vie to become this generation's Cicero, defending their well-thought-out stands with such skill, passion, and craftsmanship that others, such as the critical thinking public, can clearly understand and, if convinced, follow. In other words, all of us, leaders and followers alike, can dramatically increase our freedoms by changing our discourse from whatever you want to call it today to a discourse based on the simple, easy-to-learn, slightly tougher-to-master skills and techniques all of you should now know and be putting into practice. Ending this peroration, which if you recall is the name used for the climax of a persuasive presentation, we spent decades trying to spend and legislate and shout our way out of the various messes we've gotten ourselves into. Perhaps it's time to try thinking our way through them for a change. And on that note, I'd like to close out this last Critical Voter podcast. I kind of let the cat out of the bag last show when I first referred to this podcast as a course, for it's always been envisioned as something you and I could participate in that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Not an exhaustive or comprehensive course, mind you, which means those interested in learning more have many opportunities to do so, but a course designed to provide you sufficient skills to get started on a different pathway. Remember we talked about sufficiency back during the discussion of information literacy, with sufficiency defined as having enough high-quality information needed to answer your well-conceived questions? Well, in this case, I've tried to answer the question of how to become a critical thinker by providing a set of skills that, taken together, will help you manage challenging situations, especially those involving weighing issues and avoiding being manipulated. In other situations, you may find you need different skills or need to balance the skills you now possess differently. For example, if you're a computer programmer, then thinking logically will probably take up more of your day than thinking rhetorically. But even in this case, you're still going to have to tap into those persuasive skills when it's time to lead a team, request project approval, or ask for a raise. Or a date. The specific background knowledge you need to apply will also vary. Lawyers need to master a body of knowledge related to law, for example, while chemists have to know their atoms, molecules, and bonds. But both these fields and all others will use the tools of logic to put that body of knowledge to work, will use the tools of persuasion when they have to explain their work to others or engage in any form of communication. This broad and ongoing applicability is vitally important, since the material in this course is meant to be relevant long after this year's campaign is behind us, and we can no longer remember why we got so upset about this video or that debate performance. In fact, I expect it'll be much easier to teach and learn this material once passion's cool and the entire election becomes just a historic artifact that we use to illustrate various tools and techniques. While this is the last podcast in this series, I plan to continue working on the Critical Voter site, tightening a few bolts here and there, updating the curriculum and lesson plans to make them even more useful for teachers, and adding more bells and whistles, possibly including an online assessment to the site. In case you didn't notice, I said this would end this series since I've enjoyed the whole experience enough to say you've likely not heard the last of my voice, for better or for worse. But I shall be taking a break from podcasting to the immense relief of the first set of people I'd like to thank regarding help, support, and inspiration provided during this project. Starting from the top, special love and thanks to my wife Carolyn and my sons Eli and Ben, who put up with various pieces of recording equipment entering the house, listened to me yammer on about procatalepsis and demonstrative arguments at the dinner table, and actively participated in this entire experience, up to including appearing on the show. Thanks to all the guests that have appeared on Critical Voter, including Kevin DeLaPlante from Critical Thinker Academy, Jay Heinrichs, author of Thank You for Arguing, Simon Critchley, moderator of the Stone Philosophy Series in the New York Times, Kami Yakovan, president of Procon.org, and the son I just mentioned, Eli, who joined us last week. Thanks to listener and longtime friend Lee, who planted a seed in me regarding an interest in philosophy that eventually germinated, allowing the two of us to now, among other things, trade fallacy jokes over long lunches. Thanks also to some podcasters I've never met, who nevertheless educated and inspired me, notably Peter Adamson, whose History of Philosophy Without Any Gap series, an ambitious project that will eventually cover all of Western philosophy, demonstrates how lively presentations of this kind of material can be. And special thanks to Mike Duncan, whose History of Rome got me back in touch with an interest in classical subjects, and who demonstrated to me and many other current podcasters that this was something we didn't need to be afraid of trying. Finally, thanks to everyone who has listened to this show and everyone I hope will listen to the show after the last episode is uploaded. And no matter where you go with what you've learned, I hope you've gained something, and I hope you've enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed making the podcast, blog, and other resources associated with this project. So thanks for joining us throughout this, the final Critical Voter podcast.